So our worship service incorporates earth elements, both during the marking of our joys and sorrows by placing stones in a bowl of water, as well as during the chalice lighting and extinguishing. In addition to making this ritual of gathering more accessible to all, regardless of age or ability, the placement of the stones in water completes the elemental wheel of earth, water, air, and fire. The element of water is essential to all life. It may symbolize the healing tears of love, compassionate understanding, purification, repose, or change, the passage of time, and the transcendence of earthly conditions. Meanwhile, the element of earth represented by the stones is a container and maintainer of life. As matter, the stones ground and stabilize us. They symbolize humility, forgiveness, practicality, wisdom, and eternity. During the gathering hymn, you are invited to come forward and place a stone representing your sorrows or joys into one of the bowls of water. And now, would you rise in body or spirit to sing our opening hymn, Circle Round for Freedom. The words are on the monitor, and we will sing it through three times. Kristen's getting a break this morning, and I'm going to talk with you about voting. So can anybody off the top of their heads, and I hope it's all of you actually, tell me what our fifth principle of Unitarian Universalism is? Come on! The use of the democratic process in our congregations and in the world. Right, and some people know that there are cards in the pews and you can see the principles there. The principles and our sources are also in the hymnal. If you turn to the first hymn, number one, and turn back a page, you will see them on the left-hand side. So the democratic process is really important to us as Unitarian Universalists. And we have a history of being involved in the running of our government in this country. There have been Unitarian or Universalist presidents and vice presidents and people all the way down to the local level. So how many of you are going out and voting on November, what is it? 6th. All of the adults in this room, right? If you've voted already, great. I will be voting early because I'm going to be working as an election official on that day. So I'm just going to tell you a quick story about when I was in 6th grade and we did some voting in our class. Now, I'm going to tell you what year that was. And you can do the math and figure out how old I am. So I was in the 6th grade in 1972. Does anybody know who was running for president that year? McGovern on the one hand, this hand, and on the other hand, Nixon. So my class, my 6th grade class, and how many of you vote in your classes, you young people? Do you ever do a vote in your classes? You've done that, you've done that, you've done that. Yeah, great. So we held a mock election in my class. And this is in Minnesota. And the vote was overwhelmingly for McGovern. There were two people who voted for Nixon in my class. I was one of them. True confession, I voted for Nixon in 6th grade. Now, you have to understand that as children, we often take our cues from our parents. My parents bless them, are conservative in their politics. I don't know what my father would think of the current administration. I know that my uncle, who was his oldest brother, struggled very, very hard with that election. But I took my cues from my parents. I knew they were voting for Nixon, and I thought that was the person to vote for. And my neighbor across the street, Philip, also voted for Nixon. I have reconnected with Philip on Facebook recently, and I am pretty sure his politics have also changed. But for a long time, he was quite conservative. And so it made sense. And he was, as a sixth grader, one of those sixth graders who was really into, you know, politics and all of that kind of stuff. I wasn't so much. So it made sense that Philip voted for Nixon. I don't know that it made sense that I did. My older siblings who weren't voting, but clearly involved in the youth movement of the time, were clearly on the McGovern side. I could have taken my cue from them. My point in telling you all of this is that it's important for us to think for ourselves. And when I reached the ripe age of 18 in college, I voted very differently. That was a Reagan year. And with that, I would invite the children to gather at the back of the sanctuary and help us to sing a blessing. I was in seminary at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago when the highly acclaimed civil rights lawyer, advocate, and legal scholar Michelle Alexander published her first book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. This book became the UUA's Common Read selection in 2012-2013 after the revised edition was published 2 years later. How many of you have read it? Anybody? One? Oh, it's about time you do. Really. I was hoping you had read and discussed it here as part of the adult learning offerings that year, but apparently not. Well, I highly recommend it, and I hope that maybe it can be put onto the schedule. Alexander is a Unitarian Universalist, and I had the good fortune to hear her speak about the new Jim Crow from the pulpit at First Unitarian Church of Chicago, where I attended services as a seminarian. As Cornell West writes in his foreword to the book, the new Jim Crow is the secular Bible for a new social movement in early 21st century America. It is a grand wake-up call in the midst of a long slumber of indifference to the poor and vulnerable. It shatters the silence, laying bare the structures of a racial caste system alive and well in the age of colorblindness. The statistics related to the pipeline to prisons, which has resulted in mass incarceration in this country, are staggering. To give you a sense of these numbers, here are just a few. Well, several. Many. 90,000 children under the age of 18 are in juvenile detention, jails, and prisons. As if that weren't enough, 65% of inmates are nonviolent offenders. 65%. Due to the war on drugs, by 1991, 25%, one quarter of all black men in the United States were under the control of the criminal justice system. The U.S. prison population exploded from 300,000 in the early 1980s to 2 million by 2006. The majority of the increase was a result of drug convictions. As of 2008, there were approximately 2.3 million people in prisons and jails, and another 5.1 million people under community correctional supervision. That's probation and parole. The population of incarcerated women is up 400% since the beginning of the drug war. Despite the fact that the rate of drug crimes committed by whites and people of color are nearly equivalent, black men are sent to prison at rates as much as 20 to 50% higher. The war on drugs is the primary reason that one out of every 14 black men was in prison in 2006, compared to one out of every 106 white men. The incarceration rate in the United States is 6 times higher than Canada and 3 to 20 times higher than other nations in the developed industrialized world. We lead. The ACLU reports that the prison system alone costs taxpayers $80 billion per year. The problem is huge. As was the case with slavery, mass incarceration is a complex economic system that benefits the upper echelon of American society. In any caste system, the number of people at the top is very, very small compared to the masses of people at the bottom, whose lives are constrained at every turn. As you know, the impacts of systems are felt well beyond those directly affected at the center of the issue. We live in interdependent and intertwined communities. When a person of color is caught up in the pipeline to prison conduit, the sting and the stigma are felt by their families, parents, spouses, children, other relatives, and their friends and community. A wage earner is lost. A caregiver is absent. Children are more likely to get caught up in the criminal justice system themselves. Families become more impoverished and need to get assistance from state and federal programs and community outreach by nonprofits and faith communities. We feel it here. The physical and mental well-being of a great many people are constrained by these circumstances. The neighborhoods suffer in terms of upkeep and businesses go downhill. Too little is done to make sure that residents have access to quality food and other necessities. Buildings and infrastructure fall into decay. This is all related to imprisoning people rather than rehabilitating them. The problem is so big, it's hard to know where to begin. In fact, the problem is so big that addressing a piece of it here and another piece of it over there will not affect the change that's needed. Somehow, we need to attack it from many directions at once. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, Universalists, Unitarians, and Unitarian Universalists have long been involved in criminal justice and prison reform efforts. Type criminal justice and prison reform into the search box on the UUA's website, and you'll get a long list of information pages, curricula, and UU news articles on the topic. For example, at the end of the multi-year study process in 2005, the UUA issued a statement of conscience, a SOC, on the topic, which built upon a dozen or more social witness statements going back to 1961, the year of merger. It says in part, "Appalled by the gross injustices in our current criminal justice system, we, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, commit ourselves to working in our communities to reform the criminal justice and correctional systems and effect justice for both victims and violators. We act in the spirit that we are indeed our sisters and our brothers' keepers. Love is our governing principle in all human relationships. Therefore, that we may speak with one voice in unity, though not in uniformity, we commit ourselves, our congregations, and our association to congregational actions and advocacy goals. And thereafter is a long list of things we can do. UU's believe that all human beings are worthy of compassion and care. If we truly respect each person's inherent worth and dignity, we can find better ways to address the social problems that oftentimes result in criminal behavior, such as abuse, neglect, poverty, lack of access to education, jobs, and medical treatments. Unitarian Universalists have an online community called the Church of the Larger Fellowship, or CLF. Are any of you familiar with CLF? A few? Oh, nice. Now, are any of you members of CLF? I am. CLF makes it possible for people who don't have a nearby UU congregation available to them to receive inspiration, to make connections, and to attend virtual worship services, among other things. A major part of CLF's mission is its prison ministry. The CLF prison ministry network is called Worthy Now. CLF membership includes those who are incarcerated throughout the U.S. prison system. There's a pen pal program. Individual UUs are often creative in their personal prison ministries. Katya Taylor, a member of the UU Church in Tallahassee, leads creative writing workshops in the prisons and has published a book of poetry called Prison Wisdom. A show of artwork by death row inmates was recently on display at Live Oak UU congregation in Texas, and my colleague Betty Schwarek is promoting this collection on her website, Unitarian Universalist Free Range Ministry. I think it would be great for this particular collection of artwork to become a traveling exhibit. CLF often includes the writing of incarcerated members in quest. Each issue of this publication centers on a theme, and contributors are invited to submit their reflections for inclusion. For example, Ted O., a member incarcerated in Texas, wrote about beginnings and said this about the beginning of his connection with CLF. I had to wallow in self-pity for a season until I came to the realization that I'm not a screw-up. I just screwed up. Getting back on track meant writing to CLF. The first letter to the prison ministry was procrastinated for too long. Then one day, I could stand it no more. I had to reach out to the UU environment to begin the healing process my soul yearns for and the restoration of a spirit-centered life. I'm glad I've overcome the friction that kept me doing nothing. Now the ball is rolling again. I'm plugged into the CLF. With your acceptance, love, and prayers, I'm happily beginning again. Educating ourselves about the prison industrial complex, the latest form of slavery in the U.S., includes understanding that U.S. prison strikes are the only way that those on the inside can protest inhumane conditions. We are clear that undocumented immigrants who have been separated from their children must be reunited, that children separated from their parents need to be made whole. Are we equally moved to speak out about the separation of families that is affected by the prison pipeline to prison? The arrest and detention for nonviolent crimes and misdemeanors keeps detainees from their families and deprives them of the chance to continue earning a living until their case is heard in the courts. Once in the system, it's hard to get out of it. Earlier this year, Susan Leslie, currently the Congregational Advocacy and Witness Director at the UUA in Boston, wrote that mass incarceration and prison reform are the civil rights issues of our time. We need to speak out about these issues. We don't want silence to imply that we assent to what is happening in this country. Make them hear you. Across the country, people are making themselves heard as they demand justice for all those within the prison pipeline. A total of 7.5 million people are under correctional supervision, including parole and probation, or in jails or prisons, and that this number includes those who have not even been to court for a hearing yet. That's over 2% of the entire U.S. population. In many states, there are ballot initiatives for prison reforms. These initiatives include increasing the wages that prisoners receive for the labor they perform. Chain gangs of prisoners, although not literally strung together with leg shackles and links of chain, are used to clean up highway medians or do other kinds of road work. And I will admit that I was a bit taken aback the first time that I encountered prison labor working in downtown Tallahassee. Ironically, I was on my way to a museum that highlighted the history of an African-American neighborhood in the city. Fair wages and access to fairly priced goods and services while serving time would address some of the unfair treatment of prisoners. Some ballot initiatives are aimed at adjusting the sentencing for nonviolent crimes as a means of addressing the over-incarceration of low-level drug offenders and those involved in property crimes. This would also impact the cost to states of incarceration. Among the ways that the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated pay dearly for the crime and the time that they have done are difficulties in obtaining employment once they are out of prison, and in too many states, the complete loss of voting rights. Michelle Alexander opens the introductory chapter of The New Jim Crow with this four-word sentence: Jarvis Cotton cannot vote. Every single one of the men in generations preceding his own has been denied the right to participate in our electoral democracy, first because of slavery, then because they couldn't vote even though they were free, and then because there were poll taxes and people trying to prevent them from getting to the polls. The reason that Jarvis Cotton cannot vote is because he has been labeled a felon and is currently on parole. Convicted felons cannot vote in Mississippi. Florida is another state where this is true. However, on the ballot in Florida this November is Amendment 4. Modern-day suffragists have been campaigning tirelessly for this amendment to the state's constitution. It is the Voter Restoration Act, and it would return voting rights to all but the most violent offenders after an inmate has served their sentence. Florida has one of the highest prison populations in the nation. One of the realizations I came to while serving the congregation in Tallahassee is that white UUs are also directly affected by the prison behemoth. Whether you know it or not, some of your fellow co-religionists have been incarcerated, or their family members have been or are currently serving time. The UUA's president, Susan Frederick Gray, is personally advocating for change in Florida ahead of the election this November. She sent an epistle to all UUs recently in which she wrote, "I am coming to Florida to support Amendment 4 because I do not want us to become a society where we so harden our hearts that one's citizenship and democracy itself is withheld as a lifelong punishment with no chance of redemption. Even when politics frustrates me and I feel disheartened by leadership, I keep voting. I do it because I remember that someone fought hard for me to have this right. Now, in 2018, Floridians, more than a million of them, are fighting hard for voting rights, and I will be there to support them. I will be there because the purpose of the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments was to prevent us from becoming the two Americas we've witnessed ourselves becoming. Amendment 4 will end disenfranchisement and strengthen democracy, not just in Florida, but nationwide." Prison reform legislation may not be forthcoming from the nation's capital. However, the pressure from citizens on state governments to enact significant prison reforms are happening in states as widely dispersed as Ohio, California, and Virginia, as well as Florida. One of the five issue areas of current concern to voice Virginians organized for interfaith community engagement is reform of the criminal justice system. This afternoon at Fairfax High School, the voice-wide assembly with Governor Ralph Northam and Attorney General Mark Herring will launch Voice's bold 2018 multi-year issue agenda on criminal justice reform, schools, and keeping families together. Voice leaders believe that reforming the criminal justice system in this state needs to start with three actions: ending the cash bail system, making sure that nonviolent offenders with drug addiction and or mental health issues have access to treatment, and restoring rights to vote, work, drive, get an education, and rent or own a home. The cash bail system creates a two-tiered criminal justice system. It punishes the poor. Cascading financial damage begins when someone cannot meet bail requirements. Detaining people who can't post bail costs the local community a lot of money, directly and indirectly. Once a person enters the pipeline to prison, it's very hard to get out of it, as I said before. Among the citizens' rights that Voice advocates restoring, the right to vote is directly related to the issues of mass incarceration and prison reforms. According to the Voice briefing paper, Virginia is one of four states whose constitution permanently disenfranchises citizens with past felony convictions. And one in five African Americans is disenfranchised in Virginia. The governor has the authority to make clemency determinations and restore civil rights to former felons, but this is only on a case-by-case basis. I certainly hope that Governor Northam is more considered in his decision-making than what I've seen from Florida's Governor Rick Scott, who can be seen in a video of a clemency hearing saying that he is denying clemency just because. Literally. He gave no answer to the African-American man who had rebuilt his life after release from prison. "I'm denying it just because." And the guy asked, "When can I come back?" And Scott had no answer for him. I hope that as many of you as possible will be able to attend the Voice Action this afternoon and make Governor Northam and Attorney General Herring hear you. You will be speaking up for those whose rights have been denied. our support and our actions on behalf of the incarcerated give them a measure of hope. That hope can only help prisoners to begin to heal, to transform their brokenness into something worthy now, to foster persistence. One incarcerated CLF member wrote poetically that yellow-helmeted dandelions symbolized persistence to him, the cracks that let the light out as well as in allow us to nurture hope, hope for redemption, a hope that says, how can I keep from singing? Would you rise in body or spirit now to sing hymn number 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song. Please join me now in a time of prayer followed by silent meditation. Make yourselves comfortable. You may wish to close your eyes or not. Focus on your breathing. There is a lot in our world that is challenging, difficult, downright hard, hard to bear sometimes. The things that are done by humans to other human beings. There is so much violence in our world, so much despair, so much isolation. We bear in mind that not all of what we share is something that we can say out loud. But we share in the sorrows around us. We share in the wish for those whose health is compromised to find strength, to find persistence, to find new ways to meet others, to get out of themselves, to be in community, because those connections and relationships are so, so very important. When we reach out to those who are struggling, we provide a little bit of hope, a little bit of light. We let the light out through the cracks in our own lives. We let the light out, but we also let the light in, into our hearts. There are times when we struggle between the pain that we feel and what we know would create more pain in the world. And we seek always for ways to lift up joy, to lift up beauty, to lift up the light. Please join me now in a time of silence. Amen. Blessed be and namaste. The words of my benediction are by another CLF incarcerated member, George, in Ohio. Free on the inside. What is freedom? Is it an ideal, concept, or right? Why are there so many people who are locked up inside themselves? I've seen those who had come to prison before they could learn what it meant to be free on the inside. It's liberating. True freedom starts when we remove self-doubt, stop limiting ourselves, and find the things that empower us. Freedom is not the pursuit of happiness. That pursuit is in opposition to freedom. Seeking happiness is like trying to get to tomorrow. It never comes. Freedom is being free from restrictions, limitations, social norms, expectations, false hopes, etc. Freedom is also knowing that we are made of God. Every cell within our body is infused with God's energy. Therefore, we are created to be divine. We are more powerful than we know. We are free. We extinguish this chalice, for the worship has ended. Our service begins.